Accession number 20606, Reel 1.
Mr. Skinner, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in London in March 1931, in St. John's Wood.
I think you were telling me earlier, off the record, that you have military service in your family background.
Yes, really through my father, who was in the Royal Flying Corps in the First World War, and he served in Mesopotamia in 30 Squadron. And then was very keen and joined the RAF in the Second World War. But by that time, of course, he was a bit too old for active service, and he spent a number of years in the war room in Whitehall.
Did you tell me that there are already records about your family in our museum?
Yes, my father was interviewed by a member of the Imperial War Museum for his service, or his memories of his service during the First World War. Whether that was recorded or whether that was just an interview, I don't know.
Can you tell me something about your education, please?
Well, I was educated at Ampleforth. I was, during the war, I went out to South Africa and spent my early years out there. In a way, I was sort of evacuated. I went out with my mother and spent the war in South Africa. My father was running one of the training for the RAF pilots in South Africa, and he was able to come out to South Africa. And I spent 4 years out there, and then came back to South Africa and went up to Ampleforth in Yorkshire.
When did you go out to South Africa?
I went out just after Dunkirk in 1940. I suppose I was probably too young really to realise the danger. We went out in a ship called the Warwick Castle without a convoy, and it was amazing really that we managed to get through to South Africa without being torpedoed.
Did you run into the enemy on the way?
No, it was the captain of the ship sort of zigzagged all his way down to South Africa, and we went there non-stop. We didn't stop anywhere on the way.
With whom did you go?
I went with my brother and my sister and my mother. And then my father came out just after, about 6 months, a year later, and joined us out there. And he was in the RAF, training pilots, RAF pilots to fly before they were sent back to England.
Where were you living in South Africa?
We were living in Pretoria. And he was running the airfield the scheme, Empire Training Scheme it was called, at an airfield called Zwartkop Airfield.
What was life like for you in South Africa during the war?
Well, it wasn't bad at all. Obviously, there were shortages and so on. I went to a school in Grahamstown, which entailed a 2-day journey by train. And we only came back twice a year because of the distance. And I went to school down there. Grahamstown was a very much a scholastic town. It had Rhodes University, as well as a number of independent private schools.
Did the war affect your life very much?
Not until we came back, and then really not to any great extent. We came back just at the end of the First World War, at the end of the European War, but before the Japanese War had finished. It was really only things like rationing and so on which affected me, but otherwise not.
What was the attitude of people in South Africa towards the war?
It was very mixed, actually, because they were, a lot of them, of course, were anti-British. They were Boers, Afrikaners. They weren't very keen they weren't very pro-British, shall we put it that way, on the way the war was conducted. So there was a certain amount, I did find a certain amount of anti-British feeling out there.
Were all the Afrikaners anti-British?
Well, not all of them, but most of them were. We found that, for instance, I heard from my father that when the RAF people came over to be trained, the South Africans would accept them and give them great hospitality, but they wouldn't really, give the same hospitality to their own troops, the South African troops who were fighting for Britain. But they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't look after them as well.
Why was that?
Well, I think again, because the South Africans were volunteers, there was no conscription, and the South Africans felt that it was all very well for the British; they had to fight, whereas the South Africans didn't have to fight, and therefore those that volunteered were sort of on their own, really.
Was it South Africans of English origin rather than Afrikaans who gave the hospitality?
No, I think it was the South Africans of Afrikaans descent. They would certainly give the hospitality. In fact, they were probably more hospitable to the British soldiers who were sent out to South Africa for training. And therefore, they felt that, as I say, they were conscripted and therefore they had to fight, and therefore they should be given the hospitality.
So historic anti-British feeling didn't affect that?
No, it didn't. But on the other hand, there was an anti-British feeling, but it didn't affect the British troops out there.
Were there any organisations there which took a more active anti-British line?
Well, yes, I think there was one. I was a bit too young to realise it, but I think there certainly was a very much quite an anti-British feeling. And General Smuts, who was the Prime Minister of South Africa at that time, who was very pro-British, I think he found a lot of opposition in South Africa to South Africa going into the war.
Did any of this anti-British feeling rub off on you?
No, I mean, there was a certain amount of feeling in school, at school. You know, I think there was a certain amount of teasing the fact that I was British, but I mean, it didn't affect me to any great extent.
Was the standard of living or availability of commodities at all affected in South Africa?
Yes, there was a certain amount, but it was basically just shortage of things like butter and meat. I mean, mainly that was all there was, really. It didn't really affect one, not to the extent it did over here.
What about your return voyage to England in 45?
Well, we came back on a ship called the Mauritania, which, again, it just came on its own. It was very, very full of people being returned to England. I remember we had about 10 people to a cabin. It was very crowded. It was run by the Americans. I don't think they crewed it, but they certainly had a lot to do with running the ship. But we came back without any problems. We came back on our own, not in convoy.
Where did you settle in England once you got back?
Well, we had a small house down at in Sussex, in West Sussex, down near Littlehampton, which we'd managed to leave empty all through the war, although it was right on the coast. But it wasn't affected by the invasion troops who were billeted and down there near Worthing, between Worthing and Littlehampton. And so we were able to come back to that house, to that cottage, really.
This was in 45?
This was in 45, yeah, which we've managed to hold on to all through the war.
What changes did you notice in England when you got back?
Well, of course, I was very young when I left England in 1940. I think certainly in London, the few odd times that I went up to London, bomb damage, things like that. But of course, one was still very young and you didn't really sort of know what it was like beforehand or before the war. So there was very little to compare it. I think really rationing was probably the main thing after South Africa that possibly my mother found quite difficult to cope with.
Did you then go to Ampleforth in 45?
Yes, I did, yes. I went to a small prep school in Littlehampton in order to get through the common entrance examination. But I was lucky enough to get through that, and then I went up to Ampleforth in 40, at the end of 45.
What was life like at Ampleforth in those days?
Well, it was quite difficult, I think, the people who were running it, because we, of course, we had that very cold winter, I think it was in 1947, a lot of fuel shortages, and I don't think we realised quite what a knife edge the school was living on. As far as heating, I think that was the most, there were lots of rumours which went round that the school would have to close because it couldn't get the fuel supplies. But we managed all right, and I don't think there was any problems there.
Was the staffing of the school affected?
No, not really, because in those days there were very few civilian teachers. They were mostly the monks who did the teaching. And so I don't think there was difficulty getting teaching staff. There weren't all that number of civilian teachers.
Which year did you leave Ampleforth?
I left in 1949, having been there for 4 years.
To do what?
Well, then, of course, my father had his... We had our own business. We were jewellers in Bond Street, which my grandfather had started it. And the idea was that eventually I would go into the business. But, of course, I had my national service to cope with before I did that.
Can you tell me about being called up, please?
It was a question, really, of deciding what regiment I would go into. And a friend of mine who was up there happened to be in the Scots Greys, the Royal Scots Greys, was an officer in it. And so I had got a choice of where I would go, but I decided in the end to apply for a commission with the Royal Scots Greys. I had an interview with the Honorary Colonel and was provisionally accepted, subject to getting a commission.
What did the Colonel want to know in the interview?
That's difficult to know. It was a very straightforward interview. I think he just wanted to find out that I was perhaps the right sort of person for that regiment.
What was the next step?
Well, the next step, of course, was the a medical before I left before I left the school, which I had up in Scarborough. That was no problem at all. And then it was just a matter of waiting for one's call-up papers, which arrived, the usual time, as soon as just after I left school. And I was then... went up to Catterick, where I went to the 8th Royal Tank Regiment. They were the training for the Royal Armoured Corps. And I spent, I think it was about 16 weeks up there, basic training, which was pretty horrific, because it was just at it was September, October time, weather was pretty horrible. But it was very much an eye-opener, because the people... the boys that were being conscripted really came from every walk of life. And, of course, many of them were from London, East End of London, never left home. And although they appeared to be pretty tough guys, I certainly found that they were needed a lot of looking after, really. And we were lucky that we were in what they call Montgomery Barracks up at Catterick, which were more modern blocks, where each room had about, I suppose, 6 or 8 people, rather than a long barrack block. And so there was a certain amount of privacy.
In what kind of way did these East End lads need looking after?
I think they were homesick. They had never been away from home before, and they were they hadn't ever had a great deal of discipline. So one was being thrown in very much at the deep end, and the training staff of the Royal Tank Regiment had to be and were very tough on us. So it was very interesting, and quite an eye-opener for everybody, I think.
What was their attitude towards you?
You mean the regular staff or the others?
The East End lads.
that we were a bit of toffs, if one can put it that way. We were rather picked out as what they call POs, potential officers, and we had to wear a white disc behind our cap badge as being POs, and I think we were rather picked out because of that. You know, they tried to get at us a bit, but it wasn't too bad. One lived with it.
What methods did they use to try to get at you?
Oh, I don't know. The regular staff would probably give us pretty awful jobs to do. I think it was just something we had to live with, you know, that you were slightly different from the others. You would probably become officers, get commission. And one had to be, you know, just stick it out.
What were the unpleasant jobs which they selected for you?
Well, I'm not sure they were unpleasant jobs, but certainly things like kit inspections and so on, they were really very tough on you, probably tougher than they were on the others. And you, I can remember sort of having to iron one's vest and lay out your kit on your bed, and then the... Is that going to hurt the... certainly the... you know, when they came round on kit inspections, they would just sort of chuck your carefully laid out kit on the floor and say, that's not good enough, and make us redo it.
What are your next memories?
Then from there I was went to a thing called a WASB, a War Office Selection Board, for 3 days to be picked out from the sort of the broad outline or the broad selection. I was then picked out as a potential officer and sent to Aldershot to Mons Barracks, which was the RAC training. Say one did 6 weeks basic training there, and then you went on to 12 weeks, I think it was, of specialised training for the RAC of DNM maintenance, radio, wireless, and so on.
Any memories of Aldershot?
Nothing really. We were under a wonderful RSM, or called RSM Britain, who was an amazing man, and I can remember him sort of being on the parade ground in thick fog one morning, and he would give the orders. I'm sure he couldn't see anybody on the parade ground, and he would give the orders to left turn, right turn, quick march, and so on. And in the end of the day, he would then say, halt, right turn, and the mist would lift, and he would be exactly where he expected you to be. Amazing chap.
Was the course at Aldershot of much value to you?
Oh, yes, I think it was. It was a very good driving and maintenance course. I think in 16 weeks it's very difficult to train an officer. Nowadays, if they go to Sandhurst, they spend a year or 2 years or 3 years. But certainly I found it a very interesting course to have done. And I learnt a lot about mechanics and how a motor car works, things like that. How an engine works. But of course it was far too short a time to really learn very much. And one had to wait until you got to your regiment, and then that's when you start really learned.
What type of things did you start to learn with the regiment?
That was much more things like map reading, knowing where you were going to go, how a tank worked, which we hadn't had time to do any tank training as such, gun firing, things like that.
What kind of tanks were these that you were training on?
We trained on a Centurion. It was a new tank which had relatively recently come into service, and the Scots Greys were equipped with the Centurion tank.
Whereabouts was this?
They were in Lüneburg, in Germany. It was just, as I say, that would have been about early 1950s, and Germany was still very much an occupied country. And I can remember my parents coming out for the Waterloo Ball at the regiment, and I think at that time they spent a weekend at quite a good hotel in Nuremberg and paid for it with a £2 box of Black Magic chocolates. I mean, it was very much still bartering, even in 1950.
How did you get on with the German population personally?
I had very little to do with them. there was we were tended still to be an army of occupation, and I really don't think we had very, very little contact with the German population as such.
Did the regiment give you any orders about fraternizing with them?
No, not to my knowledge. There was nothing like that. I was with them for a relatively short time. I was only with them with the Scots Greys out there until the Korean War broke out, which was, what, in 6 months later, in the summer of 1950. I think my year is correct. And that was when they asked for volunteers, one officer from every regiment, every armoured regiment who were equipped with Centurion tanks, as to go out with the 8th Hussars. The 8th Hussars had only just been equipped with Centurion tanks, and I don't think they had a great deal of experience with it. I'd had a certain amount of time in Lüneburg on exercises with the Scots Greys using the Centurion tanks, and therefore I was, I suppose, in a way, perhaps a little better equipped to know about the Centurion tank than the 8th Hussars.
What was your own opinion of the Centurion tank?
Oh, it was a very fine tank. It was the only one I had any experience with, but certainly it was a fine vehicle, and certainly no problems that I experienced with it.
No criticisms of it?
No, none at all. It was an excellent vehicle, fighting vehicle.
What was the next step?
Then, having volunteered for the 8th to go out to Korea, and I think I was probably the only volunteer from the Scots Greys, so I was sent over to England in, I suppose it must have been about June 1950, where I joined the 8th Hussars as an attached officer with a number of other officers, and they took one officer from every Centurion tank regiment. There were about, I can't remember how many of them, but probably it was about 10 or 12 attached officers, and we tended to try and keep ourselves very much as members of our own regiment, even though we were attached to part of the 8th Hussars. And we actually, in the end of the day, formed an association called the Society for the Protection of Attached Officers, really to sort of, which is still going, and we have a lunch, or a dinner rather, at the Cavalry Club once every 3 years. We have another one this year. There are not so many of us left now, but they were all, we tended to form ourselves into a small group.
And then?
From there, we then went out. I and most of the other attached officers were didn't go out with the actual regiment. We went out as what they called a K reserve, Korean reserve, and we went out on a small ship called the Lancashire. Out it took about about 6 weeks going out to Korea, and we went straight to Pusan. And got out. We arrived out there in about, I suppose, November, early part of November, in 1950.
Anything to record about the voyage in Lancashire?
No, it was quite a small ship. There were really the only officers were these attached officers, and it, as I say, it took quite a long time. We stopped at all sorts of places, Aden. Colombo, Singapore. We didn't go to Hong Kong. From Singapore, we went straight to Korea. But it was a slow journey.
Had you been put into a subunit of the 8th Hussars by then?
No. We were kept. I'd done a certain amount of training at Tidworth, which is where the 8th Hussars were living, or were stationed, rather. But no, we were kept very much as a reserve to be as reinforcements, really, K reinforcements, should we be needed.
What were your first impressions of Pusan?
Very little, because we stayed in some barracks in Pusan. I was there for a relatively short time. I think probably 2 or 3 weeks, probably. And from there, I went up to Pyongyang. We flew straight up there in a Dakota, where the regiment were expected to be up there, to be in Pyongyang. And that's where I rejoined. Well, I was meant to rejoin them. In fact, I then joined another unit called a Forward Delivery Squadron in Pyongyang.
Forward Delivery Squadron?
Yes. It was one which I think was meant to put forward reinforcements in the way of vehicles. Should any of the tanks be knocked out, the idea was that they held some reinforcements who would then be brought up to replace any tanks which were knocked out. I don't think, in fact, any tanks were knocked out. I'm not sure that the 8th Hussars actually ever got as far as Pyongyang, because that was right up in North Korea. But that was the idea was that I should go up there.
What state was Pyongyang in when you got there?
It was in a. My memory, I'm afraid, is rather sort of dull on this, but I think that, or rather blank, but I think that there was a certain amount of bomb damage, but not all that amount. It was just before the Chinese had entered the war, and I was only there for, I think, 2 or 3 days, actually. And then the Chinese came down, or we were told the Chinese had entered. And we had to make a fairly rapid exit from Pyongyang southwards. And I remember sort of it being extremely cold. It was obviously just before Christmas. And we went back in a long convoy of vehicles. We were just told to get south and to follow the vehicles down.
You were travelling in a lorry?
No, I had a jeep, and I managed to get a lift with one of the other members of the unit that I was with. But it was all a little bit chaotic.
Any incidents that happened on the journey south?
No, none whatever, except it was a very slow journey back. It was basically just a convoy of vehicles, and we just kept going.
And then?
From there we went, I think my first stop was Seoul, where we stopped for a short time. We were then, by that time I was permanently attached to this Forward Delivery Squadron. And from there we then were ordered south from Seoul. We went back on down to, I think it was Taejon, where we made a fairly permanent camp. That was as far as we were told to go.
And you were with the regiment at Taejon?
No, I never rejoined the regiment at that stage. I still was attached to this Forward Delivery Squadron. I didn't think they could really find a job for me at that time. But having joined that, I stayed with them.
You mean forces were regrouping at Taejon?
Basically it was, yes. We were trying to sort out. By that time, of course, the Chinese had come down and had swept quite a long way down. And it was very much the fog of war came down, and really not many people knew what was going on.
Were things well organized there?
Not too bad. We set up camp there. It was under my commanding officer was a man called Colonel Beaumont Nesbitt, who was an ex-guardsman, who, rather like me, he'd sort of been pulled into to the job. But a very nice man. He's died since, but he was a very, very, very nice man. And he got things organized, he being an ex-guardsman. And we set up camp there.
And then?
Then from there, I was I became what they called an air liaison officer, very much on my own. Don't forget, I was only 18 or 19 by that time. and spent, I had two Australian people with me, two Australian privates, and we set up a very small unit called Air Liaison Unit on Tejon Airfield, where the Australians used to fly in every day from Japan.